Hello and welcome to a special edition of Something Rotten. This is special in that you may have already heard this episode before because this is the first episode of Something Rotten. It's the end of the year. Blake and I are taking a little break from the show before we'll be back in January with Metal Gear Solid. But we thought it was a good time to kind of republish this episode because, hey, maybe you haven't listened to it, maybe you're new to Something Rotten. And also, on a sadder note, the star of Max Payne 3, James McCaffrey, just died. And I've been thinking about that game a lot, and Blake, I assume you have been too.
Yeah, of course. It's very tragic news, you know. I think at least for the wider public, it was also very unexpected news, personally. Having grown up playing the Max Payne games with my dad as a wee lad, James McCaffrey was definitely some sizable part of my childhood, as I think he probably was for a lot of people over the last 20 to 30 years. And he went on to have a lot of roles in Remedy games and other games, most notably Alex Casey in Alan Wake 2. You know, I think like what happened is so tragic, but he definitely went out on one of his best roles in Alan Wake 2, which I think is pretty astounding. But God, what a loss. I am going to sorely miss his voice.
I agree. I think, you know, Alan Wake 2 specifically is such, he plays, I would argue, maybe the most interesting character in that game, because like he is a character who means so much to kind of Alan the writer, but also it is this very very overtly kind of metaphorical look of like Remedy looking at their own history and kind of what they've meant, and the idea of like Sam Lake, the writer of this and, you know, most of Remedy's games, being the face and then James McCaffrey being the voice is like, you know, what a kind of metaphor for like what he means to the history of these games, is like him literally giving voice to these things.
Yeah, and also a great callback to the original Max Payne, who was Sam Lake's face with James McCaffrey's voice. You know, I think I think James McCaffrey, at least in Remedy's oeuvre of games, is probably most well known for his like kind of rugged stoicism. You know, Max Payne is often a character who has one level no matter what is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, if he's at a birthday party or the worst thing in the world is happening to him, he's still just same level. But Alex Casey like showed that like within that character archetype, he had so much range and he had so many places he could take that type of character, because Alex Casey is like not Max Payne, right? Like he is in a way, but not fully. And I think like what he did with that character within Alan Wake and like within kind of his old style of character was so impressive. So God, gonna miss him so much.
Yeah, so please enjoy this this first episode of Something Rotten. I was listening back to it, I was a little worried I was gonna be like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be so cringe. I think it's better than the episodes we're doing now.
Do
we really
too.
Seem on the ball with this shit.
I do too. And you know why? This is gonna mean very little for basically 99% of our listeners, but it was because it was a Game Query production originally.
That's, I mean, you were hosting. At least you introduced it. So maybe that's the secret. Maybe that's what we've lost.
I'm a professional. What can I say? But anyway, our hearts go out to the McCaffrey family. Rest in power. Enjoy the episode. Hello, welcome to the inaugural episode of Something Rotten, a Max Payne 3 retrospective. Now, if you're listening to this, of course you are likely on the Game Query feed. And if you're familiar with that specific corner of the internet, you know that this is a common talking point for the Game Query host, myself specifically. But also possibly something long in the making. I can't believe it took us this long to do something Max Payne related. But joining me is my co-host, not AJ, not Leo, certainly not Haley. Jacob Geller is here.
The fourth
unofficial
host of Game Query. That's right. That's
right. We did kick Leo out. I forgot in the canon, Leo is gone and replaced by Jacob. So here's the sales pitch for this. Jacob and me, we're like, let's do something Max Payne related. It sounded great. Originally, we were just going to stream the game. And then we said, what if we tripled that workload by playing the game, maybe streaming it, and creating a whole mini-series book club podcast around it. Jacob, does that sound right to you?
That sounds right, but the important thing is it was for charity. So
that's true. That's true.
We did meet a donation threshold, and that is part of the reason why we're doing this. But honestly, it might have happened anyway, because both you and I have the disease where we just can't stop talking about Max Payne 3 ever. So this is therapy, maybe?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this while playing the first three chapters, which is what this episode is going to cover, chapter 1, 2, and 3. So, like I said, this is set up like a book club, so if you want to play the game along with us, pause it now. Play chapters 1, 2, and 3. It takes, like, maybe 2 hours at the most, like, if you're taking your time. But while I was playing through them, the thing I was thinking to myself... Now, Rockstar, of course, has put out... a lot of games that run an interesting gamut of qualities and narrative, I would say, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Ambition. Rockstar games run the kind of gamut of qualities and ambition, but I kind of wonder if Max Payne 3, and maybe this is something we'll have to touch on throughout the series, is Rockstar's most interesting game, even compared to something like Red Dead Redemption 2, which, while I think is great, is pretty cut and dry for what you would expect narratively from a Rockstar Western. But Max Payne 3 feels like this weird curveball in their library, not too dissimilar from L.A. Noire.
It kind of feels like alternate universe Rockstar, you know, in, mm-hmm. in a world where, like, GTA did okay, but not great. And they were like, I guess we should make other genres. And so then they became a studio that made kind of laser-focused campaigns, because Max yeah. Payne 3 is entirely not open world and yeah. fully linear. And yeah, I think I am curious if you played this with no context, if you would know that it was, if you would be like, this feels like a Rockstar game. You know, if you would be able to call that, because there are definitely studio hallmarks there, but yeah. also it's so different than especially their modern output that yeah, who knows.
I think for me it would stand out as a Rockstar game had I played it with no context, just because the trademarks are so in your face here. I mean, there's some obvious things like Rockstar's I don't know, I'm using this phrase here, but they're like mechanic incubation they do. Where something will show up in one game and be refined for a later game or used in a later game. Here, this is Rockstar as a developer's first use of bullet time, which of course is a staple of the Max Payne series, but then will later show back up in GTA 5 with Michael. He would have that same mechanic, mm-hmm. so you can see them kind of carrying things over from previous games into this one, like
yeah,
a lot of gunplay.
If you could recognize physics systems, then yeah. like all of Max Payne 3 is like a ragdoll test for GTA 5.
But even like the movement and gunplay, for better and worse, is definitely very Rockstar. It feels like playing Grand Theft Auto 4 in that it's hard to play at times mm-hmm. and very clunky. But I think the biggest standout here for me, to get to your question about whether or not I could play this game and not know it's a Rockstar game without context, is it has Rockstar's specific and unique brand of nihilism that makes it like immediately identifiable as like, yep, this is Dan Houser and his crew of 3 or 4 other writers just fucking hating everything.
Yeah, well, this is interesting, and we'll talk about this throughout the series, I'm sure, but I will put out there right from the beginning that, like, I am not a GTA guy. Like, I enjoy Red Dead Redemption, and I understand the value of the GTA series, but, like, when I log on and see, like, oh, fuckbook.com, haha, got him. Yeah. Like, I just hate that world, and I hate living in it. And Max Payne 3 is not far off, and so it's weird that I like this game so much, and I think I will be trying to figure out what exactly the line is between this and GTA, which are so aesthetically similar in so many ways, that makes this work for me and GTA not.
Well, I think, you know what, to shout out another game YouTuber here, Errant Signal. I recently watched his video on Grand Theft Auto 5, and he talked about some of the, like, I think I'm thinking of the right person. But he talked about some of the, like, dissonances between the story. No, it was Grand Theft Auto 4. Apologies. The dissonances between the story Rockstar was trying to tell and the world of Grand Theft Auto, where Grand Theft Auto 4 is trying to tell this, like, very bleak immigration story about what it's like to come to America for an immigrant in search of this, like, you know, Ellis Island American dream, only to be met with, like, how America treats immigrants. But around that is this, like, very crass, unfunny, South Park-esque, mm-hmm. like, humor that the Grand Theft Auto series is known for. But Max Payne 3 is more honed in on the bleakness. You don't
yeah,
get...
Yeah, this game doesn't... Max has a sense of humor, but yeah. the game doesn't really. Like, the world that he lives in is not a satirical world. It is, you know, they want you to feel like this is as fucking gritty and real as, like, anything. And
yeah.
honestly, to a level that almost becomes self-parodying in just how gritty it actually is.
Mm. I think maybe this will be a good place to transition to kind of where the Max Payne games came from and why Rockstar made 3, but that is in and of itself a little bit of a departure from Max Payne 1 and 2. Not in the sense that I think those games are satire, but they're definitely homages and parodies of, like, classical noir and kind of hard-boiled crime dramas
mm-hmm.
that this game also strips back. Like, the Max Payne 1 and 2, which Remedy took out into later games, had those TV shows you could watch, which were basically like NYPD Blue or something you
yeah.
could watch in series. It what I'm trying to say is it lost a lot of the camp.
Yeah, Remedy has always had that level of just kind of self-awareness in their games mm. where they know they're a little silly and they will, like, put nods in to their games being a little silly. And yeah, this game takes itself so seriously in a way
yeah.
that both the Remedy games and even kind of pulpy, noir-y, like, you know, the things that they were drawing inspiration from didn't. Like, even those kind of dime store novels knew
yeah.
they were operating in a genre. And this game kind of feels like it... it's unclear how self-aware it is about the tropes that it's using.
In that sense, it feels unique to Rockstar's catalog, at least at this time, but very indicative of a lot of the games that kind of began coming out around that time and are certainly still coming out, which aren't necessarily just prestige AAA games, but the self-serious, almost, like, unaware that they're too self-serious games. Like,
mm-hmm.
The Last of Us is a good example. A game I like a lot, but, you know, is kind of the same fucking angry daddy game that Max Payne 3 is.
The vibe is kind of like, oh, you think video games are just games? Well, I'm gonna show you how unfun we are, and then we'll be,
yeah.
like, a real story. Like, it's kind of... It wants to be taken seriously so much that it just has, like, zero humor about itself.
Yeah. I think a good parallel to draw right here is God of War 2018 or 2017 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
of a game that is lacks the self-awareness to know that it's maybe a little too serious. Like, Kratos is serious in that game to the point that it's kind of hilarious in some cutscenes to watch him just sitting there brooding. And, like, this game feels like it dances the line very well of doing it well, but not to the point where it's, like, tiresome. Like, I like Max's story,
yeah, well,
even
we,
though it's
we will.
Dark.
I think we should start. Let's start
sure.
talking about the game itself, because I think there are parts where it succeeds and parts where it's interesting you use the word tiresome, because I definitely think it wanders into that territory sometimes. But just from like a personal level, how did you first encounter this game? Like, did you play it at release? Were you like excited about it? What's your kind of history with Max Payne 3?
I don't remember if I played it. Had to have been close to release because I was still in high school when I played it. Mm-hmm. This game came out my senior year of high school. But I don't remember a lot of, I guess, like, excitement for the game. I had to have been, because I've been a fan of the Max Payne series, like, literally since I was a kid. My dad had a bootleg copy of Max Payne 1 mm-hmm. that I would play the ever-loving shit out of as a child. But it had a parental lock on it, where you could play the game, I think, with no blood. But none of the story would be there, so you couldn't watch any of the cutscenes. So it was like years later that I would see all the comic things. But yeah, I don't remember a ton about playing it for the first time, other than liking it a lot, except for the mission and the office, which we'll get to in later episodes.
Ooh,
I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, because I ask kind of because, like, I didn't know anything about this game or this series at all. I'm trying to I'm looking on Steam to see when I got like my first achievement in it or something. Mm-hmm. Because like I had kind of like so I got it in July 18th, 2013. When did this game come out?
2012.
Okay, so I got it only like a year after it came out, but it was just mm-hmm. for me it was like I had just built a new computer, like that was my first gaming PC year, and I was just kind of like, I want something that looks really good, that like I didn't have on console, and probably has better graphics than my PS3 could handle. Yeah. And Max Payne 3 was like on sale, and so I just got it. And I like didn't, I knew that it was a slow-mo shooting series, and I think I had actually seen the Mark Wahlberg movie before this, having like literally zero context of the character. But yeah. I came in pretty blind, like didn't know the series, didn't really know, you know, what Rockstar was doing with it. Just thought it seemed like a good looking shooter game that I wanted to try out.
So you hadn't played one or two?
No.
Have you since played them?
I have like watched playthroughs of them, so I'm aware of them, but I haven't actually like hands on the controller played them.
Max Payne 1 is pretty hard to go back to. Max Payne 2 I feel like gets a bad rap, but it is definitely maybe the standout of the series for me. I don't know if it was when I played it at like that point in my life makes it stand out.
No, but I think, like, I mean, it still has a pretty good critical reception. I mean, like, Rasevic, who's, like, a big YouTuber gamer guy, has a video on Max Payne 2 talking about how good it is. Like, I think it definitely has kind of a cult status, but people still really like that game.
Just so this can still stand amongst other Game Query podcasts, I am going to say perhaps my nostalgia for Max Payne 2 comes from the fact I had learned from XPlay, thank you very much, Adam and Morgan, of the Mona Sachs nude mod, which I exclusively played that game with. I remember this very vividly. Lord. But
were
anyway,
you disappointed that wasn't in Max Payne 3?
I'm just disappointed Mona Sachs isn't in Max Payne 3 at all. But it is interesting that Max Payne 3, it like, to use the phrase again, dances the line between being a sequel and a reboot very well. I guess it's another parallel to draw between God of War 2018. Is that when that game came out? 2018? Yeah. Where it's like at the same time God of War 4, but also God of War, you know, new God of War with the umlaut over the U. Max Payne 3 feels the same way.
Yeah, beginning, it kind of, like, there's that opening montage where it shows him doing stuff, and, like, honestly, the only thing you need to know about his history for this game is wife and kid are dead. Like, that's the only thing that matters about him, and it shows him, like, kneeling at the grave of his wife and kid with flowers, and you're like, guess this dude has a dead wife and kid. That's it. Like, that is the only kind of important part of his character.
Exactly. And I think, lowering that barrier ends up working for Max Payne 3, but I think it also means that a lot of people probably have only played Max Payne 3 mm-hmm. and not 1 and 2, which are definitely harder to go back to than 3, sometimes harder to get a hold of unless you have like a PS2 and a copy of that. Or I guess if you have a PC, they're probably pretty easy. But if you don't have a PC, they're pretty hard to get and then wrap your mind around the old controls. So I guess for anyone who isn't like familiar with the series beyond Max Payne 3, like they have a pretty deep history both in what they mean for Remedy Entertainment and kind of like how Rockstar got involved with it. So I did some preliminary research. This game was developed by Rockstar Vancouver, which no longer exists, which maybe we'll have to get into in a later episode. But they were actually shut down the same year this game came out. They were like folded into some of the other Rockstar studios, as Rockstar had like quite a few, I think, restructurings of their studios in the late 2000s. Mm-hmm. But Rockstar Vancouver, it used to be, and please stop me at any point if you want to talk about some of this stuff, because I think it is interesting. But Rockstar Vancouver used to be Barking Dog Studio, which only had worked on two games before being purchased by Rockstar. One was Counter-Strike, but specifically its Beta 5 version update, and the other was the Homeworld series for Sierra Entertainment. But then it was purchased in 2002 by Rockstar for $3 million, which is a low amount, it sounds like, yeah. for a studio. But also, like, really early into Rockstar's history, until you kind of think about what Rockstar was up to at that time, which in the early 2000s, kind of throughout the maybe mid-2000s, Rockstar was buying a lot of studios. This is like coming off the tail of GTA 3 and Vice City and San Andreas. Mm-hmm. And Rockstar is becoming the biggest fucking shit in the world, which they obviously still are, yeah. like almost 20 years later. Barking Dog was only the third studio Rockstar purchased. The first was DMA Design, which it bought really early on, which is Rockstar North now, which made the Grand Theft Auto series, Manhunt, and basically is like Rockstar's now one of two.
Oh, I forgot about Manhunt, dude. Manhunt is actually, that is an interesting point of comparison for here. You keep going with the production, mm-hmm. but like if you want a game that, talking about Rockstar games that like take themselves as seriously as one possibly could. Like, that's an interesting kind of touch point.
I was thinking about Manhunt while playing through the first three chapters mm-hmm. today. But I bring all this up, like, so Rockstar had bought DMA Designs, which is basically now Rockstar's primary studio along with San Diego. Mm-hmm. And they had Rockstar Toronto at the time, which I'm not super familiar with their history. And then this was the third one they purchased. And then a couple months later, they bought San Diego, which is like their other North. It's like Rockstar North is the GTA studio. San Diego is the Red Dead studio. Mm-hmm. And then they all kind of work on the same thing. I bring this up because Rockstar buying all these studios, on the one hand, was just a trend of Rockstar at the time. When I spoke to one of the co-founders, Jamie King, a few years ago about buying San Diego, he said that when collaborating with a third-party developer on a series doing well, and he was talking specifically about San Diego, to be clear, buying that studio helps build up a franchise, so it scales headcount and grows profit. That said, I don't really know why they bought Barking Dog.
We want these guys to make Max Payne, because they didn't do that for 10 years.
And they had no prior history with Rockstar, which is interesting because San Diego had done Midnight Club, Smuggler's Run. They had published Red Dead Revolver, Mad Doc, which was became Rockstar New England, had done Bully Scholarship Edition before being purchased DMA. Anyway, there's obviously a reason. I just couldn't figure it out why. Mm-hmm. But I bring all this up because it's going to help you understand how Max Payne 3 was made later on and maybe why it was so troubled. But anyway, they purchased Rockstar Vancouver, and the first game they were supposed to make was a Spec Ops game for PlayStation 2 that was canceled. I don't know why. But a weird fact about that is Josh Holm was from Queens of the Stone Age, and his collaborator, Alan Johannes, who I'm not super familiar with, was supposed to score that game. Vancouver went on and made Bully, which came out in October 2006.
You know, actually, hold on, I'm going to interrupt you.
Okay.
Being scored by, like, oh, interesting pre-existing band, they did stick with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You
that
know,
was, if that was a studio staple, they did
if you
that.
If you dig through Rockstar, they kind of haven't changed their approach to games basically since the inception of that studio, and that's just one of many examples.
Work your players, work your developers to death, and then make billions of dollars. It's a successful strategy.
And make games that aren't always very fun to play. But anyway, so they put out Bully, which is like this huge cult hit, and they're going to go silent in the story for a little while. So Max Payne 1 and 2 were developed by Remedy, who went on to do Quantum Break and Alan Wake and most recently Control. And the way Max Payne 3 comes out as a Rockstar game is this was only Remedy's second game, which, to get into their history, kind of like laid the foundation for its later games, which are like story driven worlds where like the world is just as much of a character. If you think of Max Payne 1 and 2, like New York feels kind of like a character as much as Max does.
And I mean, even the weird like watching TV shows thing has like,
exactly.
It's interesting that that has been in that studio's DNA from like day one.
Also like, first person dialogue for the character,
even using live action, you know, Max Payne 1 infamously has like Sam Lake's face just like copy pasted onto the character.
Yeah, it's funny that they ran with that because originally, as far as I understand, maybe I'm assuming here, but a lot of that like real world FMV, or I guess at the time it was just photographs, was probably due to like technical limitations, and they've kind of just kept it going.
I mean, it's not like they were even hiring actors. It was just like, who works here?
Well, I'm saying like, but in Control, you know, it comes back again. Mm-hmm. They didn't need to.
Quantum Break is a fucking TV show.
Yeah, exactly.
So, maybe to its detriment, but it is there.
I like Quantum Break a lot. It gets bad rap, though. So that game came out in July 2001, and it was published by Gathering of Developers. It came out in July 2001 on PC, I should say. Published by Gathering of Developers, which is this weird publisher people should look up. Gathering of Developers, also called God Games, which maybe tells you everything you need to know about that publisher, who did like Serious Sam games. They published the infamous Guy game, which is a great story in and of itself. And the first Mafia
game. Not a great
game,
but a great story.
Yeah. And the first Mafia game, and God has kind of been forgotten these days, but one of the founders is Mike Wilson, who was like one of the early marketing people for id. He's written about in Masters of Doom, so it's interesting to see his like early history there. And then he also helped found Devolver Digital, which is, you know, very well known in the game industry today, but God is kind of like the proto Devolver in
a
lot of ways. Not in the sense that like God Games was this scrappy upstart indie publisher, but a lot of their like publicity moves are very similar, and it's interesting to see Mike Wilson was doing that like 15 years earlier.
They announced that E3 was canceled before anyone else did.
No, but Devolver's willingness to not attend E3 but to hang out in the parking lot across the street, that is something, if I remember correctly, that God Games did. They would just like throw barbecues outside E3. But the console port and the GBA port, which exists, of Max Payne 1,
which you should look up because, oh man.
Yeah. Was published by Rockstar, who now Rockstar is known as this company that is this like very prestigious developer who makes Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead, and that's fucking it. But they, like, a lot of their early history is they just, I mean, not to like be reductive, but they were a publisher of a lot of fucking shovelware. Honestly, they would kind of, again, to Jamie King, when I talked to him about Red Dead, he called it a relentless rate in which they would put games out. They were publishing like Austin Powers games and like this like State of Emergency and all of these fucking weirdo games that no one remembers. And then on top of that, they're putting out the Grand Theft Auto series. So without any inside knowledge of why they published Max Payne, it stands to reason it was probably just a deal they made.
Right.
Who knows if they saw it as something they would try to make a flagship series later on, But it was just another one of the fucking... If you go to their Wikipedia and just look at the games they put out for the first 10 years of their existence, it's insane. It has to be something like 40 games or some shit that they were just publishing for partners and all this stuff. Anyway, Take-Two ended up... God closed at some point. They're not super important to the story. But Take-Two, and which is Rockstar's parent company, bought the Max Payne license. Max Payne 2 came out. And then Remedy went on to do its own thing. And this is where Max Payne 3 actually comes into play. So rumors of Max Payne 3's existence started in like 2008. Strauss Zelnick kind of said in an investor's call or something, Strauss Zelnick being the head of Take-Two, kind of said in an investor's call, like, oh, we're doing it. And people just kind of ran from. But actually, I don't see this talked about a lot. Max Payne 3 was announced in 2004, a year after Max Payne 2. And it's super weird. I only saw like one or two stories about it. But basically, Take-Two CEO at the time, Jeffrey L. LePin, who left only a couple months after this happened, informally announced the game in 2004. I was like, yeah, we're doing it. It's happening. Because Max Payne 2 had not been successful. It did not do super well commercially. I'm not exactly sure critically at the time, but it was kind of looked at as kind of a disappointment, especially compared to Max Payne 1, which sold better and generally just has stuck around more than Max Payne 2.
Right, and also, I mean, 1 had like a micro budget, and so presumably 2 cost a lot more to make, and so for it to not meet the same sales would be like a big, big hit.
Yeah, so, but only a year after that, the CEO of Take-Two Interactive, which owns Rockstar, was like, yeah, we're going to do another game. And then there are funny quotes you can find on the internet from both Rockstar and Remedy. Because Rockstar published Max Payne 2, was the sole publisher, I should say. God was out of the picture. Remedy and Rockstar were like, we have no clue what they're talking about. They're like, we're not making it. We don't know who's making it. So anyway, yeah, the game was announced in 2004, but basically didn't resurface until 2008 when Strauss Zelnick was like, yeah, it's happening. And then it was formally announced in 2009. The rumors had been floating around for about a year. The game was formally announced in March 2009 and was set for a winter 2009 release. Now, if you are familiar at all with Max Payne 3, you know they missed that. It's like they didn't so much miss the basket. They shot the basketball into the next count.
They really Last Guardian'd it. Yeah.
They
Final Fantasy 13'd that shit.
If you ask me, with no insider information, I think that release date was always bullshit, but I think a lot of release dates are always bullshit. I'm not exactly sure when the game entered development, but I doubt it was too long before this. Like, I would assume probably 07, 08.
Yeah, they had, like, a storyboard, and they were like, yeah, we'll release it next year.
And that storyboard was probably thrown away multiple times, as we'll get into.
Yeah, I think you can, the game has that energy.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't have, like, definitive reasons for why Remedy did not develop this other than they were making Alan Wake at the time. So maybe they just... And they didn't own the series by any means. So it's not like Rockstar had to let them develop it. But Remedy was off making Alan Wake. So Rockstar Vancouver made Max Payne 3. And again, it's not something I'm exactly clear on why. Because Max Payne 3, at least according to Vancouver's Wikipedia page, is only the fourth game they ever made, which feels wild to me that Rockstar, without any knowledge of it, without me having any knowledge of it, was just like, let's let them tackle this huge, massive project, which is probably
why. Do you have any idea what the budget was for this game?
I saw rumors earlier today, but I didn't feel like they were trustworthy, but it was like $100 million or something
I just googled, and on some bullshit top 10 list, it says that it was $105 million, which was quite expensive for the time and now, but especially game budgets have ballooned as of recently, and so there are more games that cost $100 million. But like, I remember hearing that GTA 4 cost $100 million with, like, hushed tones. Like, can you believe they made a game that cost this much?
Yeah, and I think Red Dead cost $250 million was the story that came out from that New York Magazine article. I don't know why Vancouver was pegged to develop it. Rockstar operates in a weird way where some outside of, or they did at the time, where Grand Theft Auto, and other than Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead, series aren't beholden to being headed by a specific studio. So Rockstar Vancouver made Bully, but, you know, according to a few of the stories that have come out, Bully 2 was in development at Rockstar New England. So it's like a specific Rockstar studio at the time. It doesn't seem like they, you know, they got to hold their cards close to their chest. And so speculation is Rockstar Vancouver just didn't have a project in 2007, 2008 after Bully came out, other than like Scholarship Edition and probably some support they might have been doing on like GTA 4. And some other games. So they probably were just open. So Rockstar was like, here's the project. Anyway, announced in 2009. This fucking game was delayed no less than 3 times, but possibly 4 or 5 times at least that we heard about. And that is, I know I'm running long in the tooth here, listener, but that is assumably because the game's development was very troubled, and I pulled this from Engadget, which I think is maybe the most enlightening piece of information I found about why Max Payne 3 took so long to come out and had so many delays. So they talked to a source who was anonymous, and said virtually everything said in the original Rockstar Wives letter and by current and former Rockstar San Diego employees in the comments applies to my experience at Rockstar Vancouver. For background, Rockstar Wives letter is a letter that was supposedly written by the wives of Rockstar San Diego developers talking about the extreme and brutal working conditions on.
Yeah, basically, like, I haven't seen my significant other in months. Yeah. Like, what are you doing to them?
When that story came out, there were a bunch of stories that also came out at that time about basically every other Rockstar studio being like, yeah, it's not just San Diego. It's hell at all these studios.
Also, it should be just pointing out, it's like the difference in climate when that letter came out, you know, just even the framing as Rockstar Wives letter, although I think they called it that themselves, you know, was like a pretty sexist framing, and I feel like a lot of the outlets' coverage of it was like, oh, look at these wives complaining that they can't see their husbands or whatever, when what it really was like a letter pointing out widespread labor exploitation. but it wasn't like, at least my memory of it wasn't like, oh my god, this is horrible. It was like, it's kind of funny that all these women wrote a letter about how they can't see their husband. Like, sure. That's how it was covered, and that is not how it should have been covered.
Sure, yeah. But on the other side, a lot of other stories did come out about what it was like working at Rockstar Studios. Though it is interesting to think about where the game press was at that time, that when all the Red Dead 2 stories started coming out about the issues with crunch on that, it seemed like a lot of people had forgotten that this exact same conversation happened 10 years before.
Yeah.
launched by Red Dead 1, ironically or coincidentally enough. But Engadget's source said this came after, I think, the first or second delay to like August 2010 or something. That source was not optimistic that they would hit that because the story, and this is a quote, the game's story just went through another total rewrite earlier this month, the third that I am aware of in the past 2 years. And that means the team would have to have all of the content done by April or May to make that August release date, end quote. And then Engadget writes, further claims about the studio range from an enforced crunch mode through to the end of the project that results in 14 to 16 hour workdays, 6 or 7 days a week, to canceled 2 weeks of vacation over the past holidays. To further that, a couple of years ago, or maybe last year, Kotaku and a big report they had about what crunch is like across all Rockstar studios. I think they interviewed like 100 or so people, something fucking insane like that. Kotaku said people who worked on Max Payne 3 have described it as a death march, a brutal period of time for the company that involved long nights and plenty of mandatory crunch. And this is a quote from one developer at Rockstar's New England office. I'm going to be honest, a lot of the details of my life during that time are pretty blank. It was a lot of getting into the office at 9 or 10 a.m. and leaving at 10 or 11 at night. And let's see, that person who was salaried did not get paid for their extra hours. Instead, they had to hope for hope that the game would sell well enough to net everyone on staff a healthy bonus.
I hope that and their game wasn't helmed by Randy Pitchford. Is that
right? Right. Well, Rockstar also has had issues in the past right. with people getting bonuses. And even myself, in reporting other stories, have heard that Max Payne 3's development was fucking brutal. Rockstar, obviously, as we've established, known for its crunchy development. One developer I talked to said Max Payne 3 was not only the worst crunch he had encountered at Rockstar, the worst crunch he had ever encountered in his career entirely. So that seems like a very unanimous feeling on the various studios that work.
Yeah, it's interesting that, like, because we're talking about this more, I feel like there's kind of it's easy to feel like crunch is getting worse, you know, that like yeah. it's like we got this huge Red Dead Redemption 2 story, and so it's like, God, this must have been awful. It's like, no, it's pretty par for the course. Like, the only difference yeah. and honestly, like, not to give them too much credit, but like, better than it has been. You know, the only difference is, like, now we're asking questions about it. Yeah. But like, you know, the same thing goes for Naughty Dog, and the same thing goes for all these different studios, is, like, this has mm-hmm. been in their culture forever. And yeah. yeah, hearing stuff about Max Payne 3 has always been, like, it's like, in retrospect, it's like, yeah, no one really asked us about it at the time, and it turned out yeah. that game almost killed me.
Yeah, and so I bring all that up just to give listeners a background just on where Max Payne came from, but also to kind of set the stage, I think, for what Max Payne 3 ultimately released as in 2012, you know, three or four years after they said the game was going to come out. Because I think without that knowledge, you can appreciate or see what Max Payne 3 is a lot better by knowing the background of behind how it was made. My last point on this is going to be where it sits in Rockstar's history. Like I, you know, established earlier, Rockstar in the first decade or so of its history just basically pumped fucking games out. Like, an absurd amount of games. But you can pinpoint the moment it happened. When GTA 4 released, Rockstar pumped the brakes on its release schedule. It was still porting things, and it still does port games to anything that will run except for Max Payne 3, weirdly enough. But in terms of new games it was putting out, once GTA 4 hit in 2008, it stopped putting out multiple new games a year. It kind of shifted to this one new game a year. So you got like GTA 4 and then LA Noir and then Max Payne 3 in 2012. And it did that for like 5 or 6 years, maybe a couple years less. And then in 2013, the year after this Grand Theft Auto came out, and it...
Yeah, can you imagine if we still got one Rockstar game a year?
Nuts. Yeah, but it GTA 5 came out in 2013, then it changed completely, and then it was another 5 years until Red Dead Redemption 2 came out. So that is the point where Rockstar became what we now know of as Rockstar, where their games, again, not including the ports, which they put out all the time, but a new Rockstar game became an event, something that did not happen often. And they started to really push the budgets they were putting into these games, the technology they were putting into these games, like how many fucking stories came out about LA Noir's facial capture technology right. or whatever. Like, they were supposed to be seen as this high art, adult focused, mature stories that were gritty and violent and for an audience beyond just the normal gamer or consumer. Like, this was supposed to be shit you would watch after you watched your favorite Martin Scorsese film.
Yeah,
you'd put on your favorite Dan Houser
specifically
game.
Films. Like, you know, that's yeah. always kind of been a thing, but it's like, it feels like the peak thing they want to be is like a classic movie. You know, that's yeah. kind of like Rockstar's MO. And if I can get a little bit masturbatory about this here, like, it is so interesting that Max Payne 3 is like the game that exists on that line, because it is like yeah. it is like fundamentally a game about like being a bitter old man being forced to enter a new world, you know, that he's like not used to, and that represents like a complete shift from like who he's been in the past. It's like,
yeah,
it's hard to think of something that would be more tonally fitting for this weird period of transition for them than Max Payne 3.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to, I know that was a lot of talk, but I think that's a good place to launch into Max Payne 3, which is a very, Max Payne 3, every level in Max Payne 3 feels like the biggest set piece of another game of that time, which is obviously a product of Rockstar, you know, pumping so much money into these games, being such perfectionists and wanting to go bigger than everyone else. You get a game that, and I'm going to hand the torch to you on this, but you get a game that from the opening kind of draws a line in the sand about the kind of story it wants to tell and the level of action you're going to have to go through for it to tell that story. And it's a weird push and pull of intimacy in the story and absolute chaos in the gameplay.
Totally. Yeah, one of the things that I was reminded of playing through the first three chapters, and we will actually start talking about the game proper now, is this story asks a lot of you, like, very quickly. Is like, it, from the from the very beginning, introduces a lot of characters and says, like, here are all these characters, here are their relationships with each other. Remember this, because this is going to be plot relevant. And and then, and this is a very Jacob Gallery point, and you can say if you agree with this or not, but I think part of the experience of playing this game, especially the early levels, is kind of not knowing what's going on in a similar way to Max himself, where he is this old drug-addled dude who is in the midst of alcoholism and is, you know, playing bodyguard to this rich family, and they're just, it's like, okay, this is the sister, and this is his wife, and this is, you know, their cousin or whatever, and they're just throwing so many people and locations at you that it's very easy to lose track of, like, who is what going on. And that feels a little like being a fucked up old guy trying to keep pace with this world he doesn't understand.
So there's this thing the game does a lot visually,
like,
where
a lot.
It'll be kind of where it's like this, I don't know the proper term for it, but the layman's way of explaining it is it looks like a flash of light appears on screen, and then everything's kind of out of focus. You're having trouble seeing the colors. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
the game does this a lot.
It's kind of, one way of describing it would be kind of glitchy. Another one would be saying it's kind of like, it's like the colors get misaligned. You know, you'll see like three versions of Max kind of on top of each other, and it's like red and green and blue in just kind of a normal kind of color wheel way. But it feels like their tone is very intentionally out of focus. It's like everything isn't solid here.
It's disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
Is, I think, a good way to describe it. And for me, I guess we should establish this as early as possible, given one of the big like narrative conceits of this game. I am a recovering alcoholic. I have had to go to rehab and stop drinking, much like Max will have to do later in this game. But those specific flashes always remind me of the panic of waking up from a bender, where you don't know, you are completely disoriented on what happened, what is going on, where you are. This game is full of those moments. They come halfway through a scene where you think you know what's going on, but something about this visual cue just disorients you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's a lot of crosstalk in this game. Like, it does a really good job of making you feel like you are either drunk and unsure what's going on, or understanding that Max probably just on a base level is hungover and feeling like shit, but having to deal with all this visual and sonic information at once.
Yeah, and the fact is the story is incredibly not chronological. And mm-hmm. and the opening cutscene is really unclear, like, where that happens in the midst of the story. And throughout yeah. that opening cutscene, you are flashing to different points throughout the story, including the very end of the game. And mm-hmm. and then you kind of go back. And so, yeah, there's this feeling, you know, it's the Slaughterhouse-Five thing. He's unstuck in time. You know, you're just kind of, like, yeah. phasing through all these scenarios. And especially on a first playthrough, you don't know what the fuck is going on. Like, where you are actually supposed to be, from what perspective this is being told from. It's all mm-hmm. very hazy.
But it feels appropriate, because it feels like Max doesn't clearly know who these
absolutely.
People are.
Yes.
Because, you know, if there's one thing, Dan Houser's not the sole writer on this, but he is the primary writer. If there's one genre Dan Houser likes, it's mob and gangster movies. Mm-hmm. And something every gangster mob movie asks of its viewer is to understand the relationships and politics of the family to other families and other organizations. This game jumps headfirst into that in the, like, first or second cutscene, where it's like, here's the Bronco family that Max has been hired to be a bodyguard of. Here's how they kind of operate in Sao Paulo. Here's kind of their brother. Here's what he does. Oh, there's this cop over here and this doctor here. Here's their relationship. Mm-hmm. So on top of you already feeling Max's drunken stupor, you're hearing, you know, the sounds of a party in one of the early scenes, and also trying to wrap your mind around the relationship this family has with each other, but also the city they work in and the other people that work in the city that they're close to. And then, of course, on top of that, they throw in this fucking militia,
right?
And then a paramilitary.
Yeah, it's... and I think one of the interesting things about the very first level of the game is when, at least my feeling was, like, when you finally get to shooting stuff, it's like, oh god, something that makes sense in this very, because it's like, while the story is very complicated in this game, the gameplay is almost unbelievably simple. That it's like, yeah. you got just a dot as your reticule, and you click on dudes' heads and they die. Like, that's
yeah.
that is basically the thing. And you've got your slow motion and your set pieces, which we'll talk about, but, like, it's interesting how it takes a long time for you to get into the first shooting thing, and there's not, like, a shooting range tutorial. It's not like, okay, Max, let's see if you remember how to use a pistol. It just kind of throws you in. It's like, all right, these dudes are attacking, kill them. And then you yeah. do that. And for me, that's always kind of a relief to get there, because I feel like I'm so in over my head with all the characters and stuff, but I know how to kill people.
I think that comes down to two things. One, narratively, it makes sense that Max would be so... Max almost seems comforted by violence.
Oh, totally, yeah.
He never seems to enjoy violence, but he understands
mm-hmm.
it in a way that, like, there's... The second level takes place in a nightclub, and Max just visually looks out of his element.
He's
an old white guy. He's an old white guy in a Brazilian nightclub, so just, like, on a base level that he looks out of his place. But also, like, he just doesn't want to be there. So once the violence starts, Max is in his element. But also, to get back to kind of the simplicity of it, just when the violence hits, it's there, just go shoot things. And it also feels like Rockstar's MO, where, like, the story is always first fiddle and the gameplay comes second.
Mm-hmm.
Where when I... And this is not my first time playing the game by any means, but even this time when I got control of Max, I was like, one, where are the tutorials? But two, it's just like, oh, this is it. That's right. It's just a cover shooter.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, like, one or two interesting, cool slow-mo things it does.
And it's also, like, this game I remember getting criticism for, and I think this is a legit critique, is you cannot skip most of the cutscenes because I think they're, you know, disguised loading screens or whatever, but like, yeah, you have no choice but to watch the story for most of this game. Mm-hmm. You can't make it a gameplay first game because you just have to spend so much time watching those cutscenes. It's like they make it very hard to ignore everything that's going on outside of the gameplay systems.
Let me ask you, what do you think about, you know, having some knowledge of the first two games, what do you think about the shift in location in Max Payne 3 to Sao Paulo, Brazil?
It is... I think we will talk about this as the series goes on. It is an interesting move to make a gangster movie in some place that we usually don't see gangster movies. Like, that's, sure, you know, I think probably if you had to ask, like, one of the reasons why they did this, it would be, like, we wanted to just have a unique location because we mm-hmm. know that gangster movies take place in New Jersey or whatever, which this series mm-hmm. is kind of based in, and we do go yeah. back there eventually. But I think it's also, yeah, this Rockstar thing of, like, really liking the contrast between, like, bright, sunny, beautiful, and incredibly violent. Mm-hmm. And it's also the Rockstar thing of some pretty significant racial insensitivity, I would say.
Which, yeah, is interesting because this game has aspirations of being a critique on capitalism and yeah. kind of wealth disparity. I mean, like, literally in the second cutscene, Max talks about how, like, you know, Americans know their capitalism.
Yeah, but he
can,
but it's kind
like,
of saying it works, and so it's a weird.
Yeah, right. But, like, it's also, like, Max is making no bones about he hates the fucking rich people he mm-hmm. works for, you know? Like, Rockstar's kind of heavy-handed in that. But then, at the same time, is undermining its own ostensible message here by basically sending white guy to brown country
yeah,
to
you,
kill.
This game has a very clear color spectrum of who, like, mm-hmm. like even though the family you're protecting is also, like, you know, Brazilian or whatever, they're, like, you know, yeah. they're from that location, they, all of the thugs that you're killing are more brown than all of mm-hmm. the people you're protecting. And that could be another commentary on race, but I don't think the game makes it. You know, it feels like it's sure. just kind of easy coding for them of being like, how are we going to tell the kind of, like, hired thugs who it is your job to kill? And especially when you're in Sao Paulo, it's like, oh, you, because they're darker. Like, that's who yeah. they are.
And I mean, yeah, look, this is not necessarily our conversation to have as two white guys, but Dan Houser, I think, has not always been taken to task by some of his writing of people of some of the way he's written people of color, often as comic relief or idiot enemy foibles.
I mean, he feels like he kind of has, like, a Tarantino thing. If you think about how many times the N-bombs have been dropped in other work.
Dan Houser has given himself the N-word card with his scripts.
He sure has.
Yes. This game, though, I don't think it's a reaction to maybe any of those criticisms that maybe have been levied at Dan Houser, but it seems to want to say something about the rich and the rich's view of the poor.
Right.
But that doesn't make sense if most of your enemies are just the poor.
It's a,
you know?
It's very close to a lot of interesting things. And yeah. which is the kind of the story of this game. And some of them, it does feel like it really gets incisive on, and some, it feels like it's just inches away, but maybe doesn't quite.
Yeah, it can't always decide who it wants you to empathize with and who it wants to vilify, mm-hmm. you know? But on paper, I do like the setup to Max Payne 3's story. Like, I would have been just as happy to have another New York gritty cop story, right. but the idea of taking Max Payne out of, like, this very specific view of New York that largely exists because of gangster movies and Martin Scorsese movies, where it's always snowy and nighttime, mm-hmm. and there's drug addicts on the streets with guns and shit. Like, all this very pulpy, these pulpy views of that city. Removing Max, who fits very well into that whole, right. like, archetype, like, of that city.
That is what his character is drawn around. You know, like, the trench exactly, coat and yeah. the pistols and the, what, like, he is made to be in that world.
Exactly. And pick, like, taking him out of that and dropping him into sunny Brazil as this, like, gun-for-hire bodyguard, basically, is, like, an interesting setup mm-hmm. and a good way to take the one or two things it's carried from Max Payne 1 and 2 over to Max Payne 3 and tell the kind of more interesting... There are two stories going on in this game. There's the story of the Broncos, and there's the story of Max. And while those stories are often intertwined, they're largely separate. Mm-hmm. I think the location benefits Max's story, which ends up being the more interesting story. And then the Broncos... it's just another story that's happening at the same yeah. time. But
getting back to let's get back to, because I do want to like talk through the levels themselves. So the first level, you're introduced to all the Broncos. Some dudes break in seemingly with the goal of like kidnapping some of the Broncos to just, you know, hold them for ransom or whatever. And so you start doing your Max Payne thing and just kind of gun through this really lavish mansion, you know, that mm-hmm. they're in one of these kind of like houses on a hill where you, in the very first scene, you kind of look down at all the slums mm-hmm. and then you're like, oh, we're up here and they're down here. And you gun down all these people in this mansion. You do a really cool thing where you kind of slide down a roof and shoot a dude who's holding someone, and then you fall into a pool, which is...
it's very cool, and then repeat it a bunch.
You do, yes. There are almost every level has something like this, where it's a big slow motion set piece where all your job is to do is to shoot people, and while you're doing that, Max is doing something ridiculous. And yeah. then at the end, you basically... you know, it's like they almost get away, you shoot the tires off a truck, and you kill everyone. So this whole level is just kind of setting, like, this family is at risk. The reason you're here is because they are desirable for you know, people to hold for ransom or try to hold up or do any number of things with.
It's under-tutorialized in a way, which is very interesting. I only found out because someone was killing me that there were on-screen prompts telling you how to play. I guess there are other ways to trigger that, but the game basically just let me loose. I had to look up how to do the cool jumping move mm-hmm. where I fly through slow motion. The only time the game ever was like, hey, here's how you play, is when a dude ran up on me and I was trying to find out how to kill him. And they were like, oh, it'll go in slow motion if you're about to die and you can have a second to shoot mm-hmm. at.
Yeah, but so this game, you know, the basic functions of the Max Payne universe are you can slow down time, which is on a meter, and so you have like a limited amount of time you can slow down, and you can also kind of dive through the air, and when you dive, time is automatically slowed down. And so you can avoid bullets and shoot people that way. And this game also adds, I don't think this was in the previous ones, a pretty rudimentary cover system where you can mm-hmm. you can just kind of snap to cover. It's not, I don't think it's a game meant to be played from cover, but it is a design change from the previous ones where before you were really just running through and shooting guys before they shot you. And in this one, you do have to do a little more ducking and popping up and stuff.
I think this first level, Max Payne 3, kind of shows its hand with what may be pretty frustrating for a lot of players. And that's the ways that, like, the story and the cutscenes and the production are all very expensive looking and shiny and look cool. Like, the game's almost 10 years old and it still looks yeah. great. The gameplay, though, is kind of rough. it is kind of a pain. And I'm playing on console. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you talk because I have feelings on this. Okay. But you go first.
So I'm playing on PS3. And from second one of gameplay, I was like, I forgot that this game is very clunky. It is hard to get it in and out of cover. The soft lock often likes to either not work or lock on to the wrong target. It didn't tell me how to do a lot of things. I spent a lot of time pausing and looking up the controls to figure out how to do like the jump thing. And he has a roll maneuver he can do, which is very helpful. I couldn't figure out how to do that. I don't want to be a person that says that it feels like one thing was a victim of the other, or priorities were in the production as opposed to the gameplay. But almost instantly I was like, this is hard to control and very hard to play. And I'm maybe not having as much fun right now as I thought I was going to be having in these early moments, which persisted through the first three chapters.
Well, so it's interesting that you say that, and you can say that because I will be the other voice here. And first, okay, I should say, I've only ever played this on PC. I've never played the console version. I fucking love how this game feels. I think it is so good. And part of that might be the aiming expediency that I have with a mouse, because this is a game with small targets and not a lot of automatic weapons, which are usually things that games give you. You know, it's like, every game has assault rifles because it's easier to hold down a trigger than click it once. Like, that's just kind of how it works. But with a mouse and with just the amount of time that I've played, I know how Max moves, and I love how physical everything feels in this. Like, this is a game that simultaneously feels very weighty in terms of how slow characters are and how they fall, which I think we'll save for like another episode talking like the intricacies of this game's physics system, but like, goddamn, they are impressive. But also life is very fragile in Max Payne 3, both for you and for everyone else. Like, one headshot on a unhelmeted enemy always kills them, no matter what. Like, if you get a headshot, they're down in one. And you also can't take many shots. You're a pretty pretty fragile dude, and all of the bullets are moving very fast. It's not like a Halo game where you can kind of see stuff coming and get out of the way, unless you're in slow motion. But usually, you know, it's a game where encounters last seconds at most, where you see a dude off in the distance and either you get the first shot off on him and he goes down, or he gets the first shot off on you and then you really have to scramble to kind of get back to where you're going. And so coming back to Max Payne 3 is now kind of like coming back to an old friend for me, because I just like know it so well. But it is there are very specific decisions about how this game feels, I think. And it's one of the things that I kind of like about modern Rockstar. It's one of the things I like about Red Dead Redemption 2, is how things don't feel like that choice was made just because of how all other games feel. You know, that this was like, no, we're going for a specific vibe, and so we're going to do this one. And in this, I think that vibe is a man who is capable of great feats of skill, but is also pretty clumsy about them. Because one of the things I love about like the shoot dodge, which is when you jump and it's slow motion and you shoot, is that this game makes it really easy for you to just like jump into a wall and fall down and be completely open. Like, it doesn't make it cool automatically for you. You kind of have to like make it cool by yourself. And there are lots of situations where Max just ends up lying on the ground, and then you kind of have to like tell him to get up. And it's just it's so weird. But like, how many other games do you play that are primarily shooters where the character is like an old man lying on the ground for a lot of them?
Mostly just Rockstar
games. Yeah, that's true. You got a lot of those.
The issue I kept finding with the gameplay, at least on console, was it couldn't make up its mind on whether or not I should be behind cover, like I'm Nathan Drake or something, or I should be running around shooting in every different direction, like early Max Payne games. I would enter a combat scenario and couldn't figure out, okay, is this the one where I hide, or is this the one where I'm running and jumping and going in slow motion? And, you know, let's get back to the story a little bit to establish how we get here, but I think the biggest center of that is the soccer stadium level, where every gunfight I feel like I died on, and I was like, I don't know what the game
that
wants
level's
for me
pretty
right
rough.
Now.
We were messaging about it before this started.
It's
that,
yeah,
that is that's a level where a lot of the design conflicts kind of rear their head at once.
Yeah, so Max, after the kidnapping of Fabiana Bronco, the wife of what's the guy's name? They're all just the Broncos to me. But basically, the wife of the guy in charge has been kidnapped. So Max and his buddy, Raul Pascal, I've got to look these names up. I'm not going to try to navigate this. So Fabiana Bronco gets kidnapped, and Max and Raul Passos, if I'm pronouncing
it, I mean, Max pronounces it about as whitely as he can.
Actually, I think at one point early in the game, he calls him Pesos, which is a little weird. So basically, they're like, all right, well, the Broncos are just going to pay to have her released. They'll pay the ransom or whatever. You go. This all happens at a nightclub. She gets kidnapped. It's basically just a shooting gallery. That whole thing doesn't really advance the story much other than just kind of some character exposition about the Broncos.
Though I will say, when I think about Max Payne 3, like, that nightclub is kind of the level I think of, just in terms of...
It is amazing.
Like, it starts... You're in... you know, you're just grumpy and you're kind of escorting them and you're in this VIP lounge and then a bunch of, you know, dudes come and start kind of like shooting guns in the air. And as Max, you run, grab a dude, smash through a window that's kind of like 10 feet above a dance floor. And then the game goes into slow motion. And as you are falling the 10 feet or so to the ground, you are just shooting like all the dudes on this dance floor, and it is an incredible scene. I mean, like, the level of kind of like color variety and music going on, like it is a thumpin' club soundtrack and whatever. Like, in terms of just level construction, making it feel good to run through and shoot guys in, this is a pretty high peak for the game.
For sure. I think of the three levels we played, that's the best one. But narratively, it doesn't serve much other than you get to spend a little...
He's grumpy. He doesn't like being there. He says, this place is like Baghdad with G-strings. Classic line.
Yeah, very good moment. The only thing it kind of serves is to show you that, like, the younger of the Broncos is a
idiot.
Naive...
Yeah,
that's like... It doesn't really... progress much in the story other than that. So the point where the story kind of gets picked back up is a lot of what we were talking about earlier with the politics and the family from the very beginning of the game. You start to see more of in this third level where Fabiana is being held for ransom. And, you know, in a lot of movies, the ransom is like, how are we going to get the money to pay to get her back? And we clearly see this family is wealthy beyond our understanding because he says, okay, it's fine. We'll just give them the money. It's no big deal. And then it's this comically large duffel bag they carry full of just an absurd amount of money. And this, I think, is where the story finally opens up, where you understand that this, like, scrappy gang is not your primary antagonist. There's a paramilitary group, and the game starts to throw even more things on top of its story at you, but it's unfortunate that it's in just this kind of miserable slog of a level that is such a pain in the ass to get
through. Level starts, so you're bringing this big ransom bag and you're in the middle of a soccer stadium, like a huge, you know, like 80,000 person stadium or whatever, and you're handing it off to this gang. And right in the midst of your handoff, a sniper starts shooting, you know, from way up in the stands and shoots a bunch of the, like, gang that you're handing it off to. and then shoots Max in what he refers to as his second favorite drinking arm, which I think is a pretty good line.
Great line. So
and
good.
So the first, I don't know, 10 minutes of this level, maybe it's shorter than that, but it feels pretty long, are you just kind of, as Max, just stumbling and kind of sliding off the walls, being shot in the arm and being really... This is kind of a video game cutscene thing where he gets shot a bunch, but he got shot in this cutscene and it like really fucks him up. So you are just sliding along and Passos is kind of in front of you and is shooting dudes. And eventually you get bandaged up and so you can return then to your full shooting ability. You know, all right, of your senses are returned to you.
You have a piece of cloth on the wound and you took some pills, you're fine.
Yeah, you're fine. But then, the kind of interactions this starts throwing at you are these just incredibly deadly situations where characters can kill you really quick and the rooms are pretty... I would say they're very realistically shaped for a soccer stadium, which doesn't necessarily make them super fun to shoot in.
The thing that kept frustrating me were the combat arenas where you were in the stands. It happens like three or four times where you run out into the stands and it's trying to do these interesting things where you're juggling like enemies at different heights. They're like way above you or down below you. And it's like, okay, well, you have to make sure you know what's going on all around you. But there's no real cover, and you can't just jump down an entire staircase and, like, slow-mo them all. And it just becomes
a
frustrating...
You can jump down the entire staircase, but it's not as effective as you would hope.
Okay. Yeah, it becomes this frustrating exercise in trying to memorize where each enemy group is going to come from and kill them before they can kill you. And it's just... It's an interesting part of the game because it's... adding layers onto a complex story, but feels like it's doing competently enough that I'm interested in figuring out who all these different players are in this stadium with me. But it's bogged down by having to fight all these dudes that, you know, it's just becoming an exercise in trial and error of, okay, I died that time. I need to make sure I look right first, kill that dude, then left because there's two dudes over here. And it's just not fun at all.
Also, you've got... This level is incredibly broken up with cutscenes. You know, between almost every fight, there are cutscenes that are not really story crucial. It's just kind of Max and Passos, like, talking about stuff. This level is about twice as long as the first two. I was recording them, and so I have the actual timestamps, and it's like, this level is close to... you know, 35, 40 minutes while the first two were like 20. And it's a real slog. It's hard to get through. And there are some great moments in it. You know, there's a thing where you pick up a sniper rifle and Passos is like all the way across the stadium. And so you're making these shots from like a mile away and the game.
Oh, hold on. Oh, I hate that. Oh, that is my least favorite part of the game.
This is maybe another control issue.
I'm going to caveat a lot of this conversation with saying, I think my PS3 controller is dying on me also. for some reason, when I would aim while I was shooting, it kept bringing up the weapon wheel. So maybe my controller is just dying. But also, I could not figure out if there was bullet drop, if I needed to aim before the enemies as they were going towards Passos. Like, it took me maybe four or five times just to get through that section because I could not figure out, do I need to be super precise where I'm aiming on the body, or do I need to be a little ahead of them? Should I be above them? I still never figured it out. I think it was just luck that
I
got through this moment.
I'll revise my previous statement. There is a visually spectacular segment where you are, because it will do these kind of bullet time, like, following the bullets across the entire stadium and then it like, you know, hits the dude or whatever. There's a scene, the very last scene, you're kind of climbing up on the lights of the stadium. And so you're way above everything and then you slide down and kind of flip into this room and shoot a guy. And unlike one of the things that I do just love about this whole game is, unlike Uncharted, where it seems like everything is super easy to pull off. The animation really sells that Max is not like a really fit dude, and he's very good at killing, but whenever he does one of these kind of like action movie moves, it seems like it hurts a lot. Like, he doesn't enjoy crashing through a window, and it makes it
feel... Well, and you know he's like... Yeah. And he's half drunk when he's doing any of it.
Yeah, and also, we haven't talked about that. The health system yet in this game is you are literally, like, taking gulps of painkillers. Like, your health in the corner will show that you have 5 painkillers left, and then you take out a bottle, which is... incredibly just cheesy and on the nose, but does fit the
general
vibe.
It is a holdover from the first two games, but also maybe something that could have gone away. I feel like that becoming a trope in video games, because people like that's something people remember from the Max Payne games, is like maybe this is a leap here, but part of the reason, which this game I will say does a good job of offering other takes on addiction in games, but this game continuing the just pill munching health stuff continues a lot of, I think, Max Payne's place in video games trivializing substance abuse, because that became like such a funny trope in those first two games that video games kind of ran with it. Later, Rockstar would adopt it where you like can drink alcohol and it, or you know what I'm saying, like games have stat boosts based on you getting fucked up.
And whereas I think the alcoholism in this game is taken very seriously, the pills are not really, and it's just a gameplay system.
And that shit sucks to me. It sucks when any game does it, honestly, and a lot of games do it, and it just feels like this relic of Max Payne's past that unfortunately had some bad influence on other games. It didn't necessarily need to be here. Just give me a health pack or give me regenerating health. Sure. Like, I don't need... You have a good story with the addiction stuff, with the drinking. I don't need Max's quips in the middle of a level being like, I had to numb the pain with my little white friends.
And
it's like, all right, I get it.
Boy, does this dude quip. Like, he talks about as much as Nathan Drake, but when Nathan's like... Hoo-hoo, glad this handhold was here. All of Max's life, like, this is, you know, we were talking about tiresome in the beginning of the episode, but, like, Max has the same energy for almost every one of his lines, and, like, boy, hearing him spit out another, like, I had just killed 50 people in the country's most hallowed prayer ground, when he's talking about, like, the soccer stadium or whatever, it's like, oh my God, like, lighten up a little bit.
Well, let's, maybe this can be the last thing we talk about today, is what is, because we're kind of deep in the conversation at this point, but what is carried over from Max Payne 1 and 2, and Max Payne's inner monologue, his cheesy quips that he's ostensibly saying to just himself.
Right.
Those are like staples of the first two games that I think I really appreciate, because I really like, just like, there's, I don't remember if it's something Max says in Max Payne 2, but one character says it where they're like, it was raining in the city, like all the angels in heaven had decided to piss at the same time. Like, I'm very nostalgic for that.
I think some of them work really well, like second favorite drinking arm, and then some are just kind of like, it's been 30 seconds since Max said anything. We need to.
But the irony to kind of where I come down on the pill munching stuff, that is, you know, a carryover from the first two games, and I'm largely pretty negative on that, is this game's take on Max's substance use, which was a big tenet in the first two games. I think mainly just the pills. Mm-hmm. Like, it was kind of implied, you're eating all these painkillers, maybe Max has an issue with them. But this game kind of takes that hook from the first two games and decides to explore it with Max's alcoholism. And it ends up being, like I was talking about earlier, like, there's kind of two stories going on at the same time. There's, like, Max's whole deal, and then there's the Bronco story. This story is, I think, what makes Max Payne so interesting, is this game deciding to look at this character and kind of what we know about him from the earlier games and then kind of crack it open and see where they can take him, you know, 10 years later. Like, this isn't just a PS2 pulp shooter anymore. This is a big, prestigious Rockstar AAA game, and it's very gritty and serious and for adults. And it's like, where do we take this character? And where they landed on was, like, this really interesting exploration of not only addiction, but, like, self imposed recovery. Like, Max doesn't go to fucking the Betty Ford Clinic, mm-hmm. or whatever that shit's called. Like, he's just, and we'll get into it later in the game, but Max does get sober for the most part. And this game, the first three chapters where we played, show alcoholism in a way that is very depressing. And also, at least in my experience, it's realistic. Mm-hmm. Like, this game isn't interested in being like, oh, Max got drunk and he got behind the wheel of a car and killed a kindergarten class. It's like, no, this dude goes home and drinks alone and cries. And that's what a lot of us do or did, mm-hmm. you know? Like, we didn't go party or any of this shit. It's why Max doesn't want to be at a club, despite there being all the alcohol around him. He just wants to be in his house or his apartment alone, away from everything, hiding from everyone. And this game, like, it's basically the first thing you see in this game is Max is like, I'm in Brazil now. And then the cutscene shows he brings a plastic bag home. He pulls out a bottle of whiskey and he gets fucking so drunk he can't stand. He's throwing up everywhere.
Also, another good line where he says he's got an apartment. It's certainly in New Jersey.
Yeah. I think the further we get into that, because the story is going to dig into it more, this is going to be the most interesting thing this game has to do narratively. Mm-hmm. But for you, a man who I do not believe is an addict, what do you think about this take? Because it speaks to me directly, but it's also an interesting place for a game to go, because we don't see this shit a lot in games.
It is interesting, because I'm honestly glad to hear that it does speak to your experience, because a little mm-hmm. of what I feel is, we talked about how seriously this game takes itself, and it yeah. does feel very, it's not heavy-handed in the getting behind the wheel and, you know, running over someone, yeah. but it's certainly not subtle in any way, shape, or form about this. And it's not a subtle game, so it doesn't have to be. Yeah. But I could picture a world where, you know, someone who would experience this sees this game and they're like, Jesus, I'm not like a monster. Like, you know, that Max Payne is kind of a man made yeah. up out of grief and violence and booze. And so, you know, I could imagine someone being like, this feels reductive, but I'm glad to hear, although I want to give mm-hmm. you a hug, that doesn't feel, you know, that way to you, and that it actually, you know, feels like it's, you know, yeah. actually speaking to, you know, what that felt like.
But I will say, like, the other side of that is the frustration of the way this game makes a mechanic out of substances, just because it's a Max Payne game, so he has to chew on pills mm-hmm. or whatever. And it's like, I mean, fucking, there's a million things you didn't carry over into Max Payne 3. Why do I need this? Why are you giving me such a good look and starting such an interesting conversation about addiction and recovery, but also being like, don't you remember in Max Payne 1 and 2, he chewed the pills and his health went
also,
up?
I mean, I am not a guy who likes recovering health systems generally, but it feels like this game should yeah. just have auto-recovering health. Like, it just feels like that's how yeah. it should work, and it's always kind of a surprise yeah. to me that, like, no, you actually have, like, limited heals. So, okay, so where did this leave us going into next time?
I feel like where we go next time is all the things we've established. It's fitting that we talked about so much.
That's right.
Because this game has so much going
and
on.
And it gives you all of it at once.
And it will only continue. So as this show goes on, I think we have to just stay on the same path and be like, here's how the combat evolved, or here's where the story is taking us, here's, you know, these themes that started to sprinkle in the first three chapters, here's how he start to play out. Why is Max shaving his head? That's actually a really big thing based on the
dude. This game's got some good hair, I'll say that. He's got a good beard. It does, later. Yeah. On he's
got, we do get to return to New Jersey, figure out why Max had to go to
South
Palo.
That's the next episode. I think it's honestly a really good tease, because yeah, all the chapters just flow into each other. And so as I was shutting this down, getting ready for the podcast, I was like, oh, next level's in New Jersey. This will be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, when I said this is Rockstar's most interesting game, I think there's a lot of good and bad with that. But we will... it's an embarrassment of riches in terms of things to talk
about.
That's
right.
With this game. So before we close out, if you want to play along with us, obviously, as you've just heard over the past hour or so, we played the first three chapters. The next episode, episode 2 of 5, we're going to play the next three chapters. Now, the play schedule will change up a little bit after that, I believe. But if you want to play along, play episodes or play chapters 4, 5, and 6. If you have any questions, comments, observations about the chapters you played, or just the game in general, you can tweet them at game_query on Twitter, or email us at gamequerypod@gmail.com. We have a few, but I'm going to wait till later, the next episode, to start digging into all those, because they feel like more overarching looks at the series, but we do have some we'll start getting into. So if you've written in so far, listen to episode
and
two. We'll
just to make it easy for you, chapter 6 is the chapter in the office, stop playing when you reach the end of that chapter.
Well, Jacob, this is awesome.
I'm really excited about this. This is a game that I've wanted to talk about for a long time, and I am glad that I found someone who is as enthusiastic about it as you.
Yeah, and we talked about all of it today, everything. So I'm excited to keep going. For anyone who wants to follow you, hear your other work, your other podcasts, watch your videos, all that good stuff.
Well, my YouTube is Jacob Geller. Just type that in. My Twitter is currently suspended because fuck that, but hopefully by the time you're hearing it, it won't be. On Twitter, I'm also Jacob Geller, or at JacobG42. And if I'm still suspended, hashtag free Jacob Geller.
Hell yeah. And I've been your illustrious host, Blake Hester. Follow me on Twitter at MetallicaIsRad. Maybe, just maybe, I'll have a Rockstar story, maybe two, coming out in the near future. So I'm always knee deep in Rockstar. I've decided it's just one of my beats at this point. So I'm glad this is one of many in the catalog of my Rockstar library of stories. But yeah, thank you for listening to Something Rotten, the inaugural episode of our new Max Payne 3 retrospective. Write in with your questions, comments, concerns, observations, gamequerypod@gmail.com. Looking forward to the next one. Good night.